Okay, we'll call the next case, which is case number 61027, In Re City Center Construction and Lien Master Litigation, the Converse Professional Group, petitioner versus the A Judicial District Court respondents, and Century Steel and Pacifico Steel, real parties in interest. Okay, and Mr. Burris, you're going to argue on behalf of the petitioner.
I am indeed, Your Honor, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. I'm Scott Burris here with Mike Edwards on behalf of Converse Consultants, which requested this writ petition because the issues here will have far-reaching implications on other cases, a far-reaching impact on judicial efficiency and fairness in other cases, especially those involving design professionals whose work falls under the practice of professional engineering, such as Converse and as determined unequivocally by the Nevada Board of Engineers. In any event, I hope to simplify some of the complications related to the insufficient allegations and some of the verifiably false accusations that contributed to the lower court's orders, which we would like to have vacated by this writ. The lower court's two orders granting the motions for leave to amend, especially regarding the fraud claims, involved prejudice and unsupportable accusations failing to meet any pleading standard by Century Steel and Pacific Coast Steel. And for background, they're the real party in interest that actually constructed the Harmon Rebar with crews of 20 to 30 workers, day shifts, night shifts, three foremen on site, detailers, every one of whom was charged with both a quality control and a quality assurance duty. And it was their sole responsibility to construct every square inch of rebar properly, and notably to preserve the inspected conditions after each inspection by the single rebar inspector. Mr. Wall was absolutely incorrect in stating that there is a second rebar inspection. However, the workers have testified that following each inspection, they made some changes to the rebar. In the night shifts and the day shifts that followed each inspection and prior to the concrete pours, the workers admit they made changes due to congestion during formwork installation, and they did not ask for a re-inspection after making those changes. They knew when our inspector was going to be there and when he was not, and they took advantage. Yet, ironically, most of us concede, after having seen now thousands of pages of construction photos, that there are indeed acres of rebar that is laid out correctly and in accordance with the approved plans. So I believe that most of us understand that the congestion-related problems are related to the concrete dimensions being too tight and that there are some repairs that are necessary. However, despite the information from their own workers, who they needed to interview before making allegations pursuant to Rule 11, their attorneys capitalized on the prejudice in the media and misleading statements about the informal proceedings by Clark County involving Converse. And the lower court was persuaded by those statements in granting the motions for leave to amend. Yet the Clark County documentation involving Converse, and it's not very much, it states up front that this documentation is limited for use in that proceeding only. That is, the introduction to the building official's final report, which PCS and Century and the media have misquoted repeatedly, states, findings, conclusions, and recommendations contained in this final report and the hearing officer's documentation are limited for use in this administrative proceeding only. Therefore, the Clark County documents constitute inadmissible and unreliable hearsay. Yet, here's what the lower court stated during our hearing for reconsideration of this motion. The court, I think we have more information than needed to survive a 12B5 motion on the fraud, given the allegations made relating to the findings by the Clark County Building Department. She goes on, if you're asking me to rule on a 12B5 issue, given the allegations that have been made related to the Clark County building officials' determinations, it looks like they might have enough to get past a 12B5 motion. And the lower court stated, that PCS and Century do have enough facts for fraud based on the Clark County determinations, even though those determinations defy the possibility of fraud by Converse. They defy the idea that Converse is responsible to PCS or Century, and they defy the use of these documents for any other proceeding. And for this purpose, and we submit that the court should defer to the building official's limited use instruction, especially because after we have sat through now nearly 200 depositions and vast discovery in this case, even the actual statements made by Clark County are inaccurate and incomplete, with a couple of notable exceptions. The Clark County hearing officer stated, quote, Converse special inspectors did not discover the errant steel reinforcement placement by Century and PCS. We agree that Converse did not discover the defective work, which defeats their fraud claim. But we also found out that Converse was not required to discover what happened after Converse's inspections, because the county and the owner, MGM City Center, had changed Converse's rebar inspections from the typical continuous rebar inspections to the intermittent spot checks by writing. Mr. Wall is incorrect about his overstatement of our scope of duty. And they did this despite Converse's express objections nearly a year before the problems were identified. Even so, we ask that you please note that the building official and the hearing officer never state that Converse falsified any reports. They don't even use the word false or any derivative of the word false, much less falsify, fraud, or misrepresentation. As we know, the proposed amended pleadings had no cause of action for fraud or intentional misrepresentation by PCS nor Century. And that is because we submit that would have violated Rule 11. They accepted the lower court's invitation to give it a try. If I was in their position, I would not have done that. I would have declined. Mr. Almohandro states that, well, Converse had notice of the fraud claim because they're running into a statute of limitations issue as well. They say we had notice of the fraud claim since the case began in 2010. However, he's admitting then that they had notice of a potential fraud claim in 2010, and they should have brought it then. But if we look more closely, there is a more serious problem. Mr. Almohandro told the lower court that Converse has, quote, obviously had notice of the fraud claim from back in the original third-party complaint that was filed that included the allegations related to Clark County. That's in paragraph 651. End quote. He references PCS's former false allegation number 651, which was indeed the strongest allegation ever made against Converse, but its verifiable inaccuracy led to two Converse motions to strike, and both of which we submit in the interest of justice and judicial efficiency should have been granted. PCS took out that allegation number 651, and they never put it back in. Now, hypothetically, if they had left number 651 in their new complaint, we would concede, for Justice Saeta, we would concede that there is an allegation giving rise to an inference of fraud, but it would still only be a weak inference of fraud because fraud requires five elements, which they cannot meet. And even though they deleted number 651 and never quoted those words again, they continued and still continue to reference their own false allegation. And in my opinion, that should not be tolerated. Motions to strike should have been granted. And in all candor, that is part of the problem. So Mr. Almohandro urged that Congress was supposed to have notice of their fraud claim based on a false allegation that they themselves do not dare to use again. Because it is wrong, here's what it says. Number 651. A hearing officer appointed by the Clark County Department of Development Services concluded after administrative hearings, I have to stop right there, their inferring preclusion and res judicata without disclosing the limited use instruction by the building official who says it's limited for use in that proceeding only. They don't disclose that. They're saying, court, there's a preclusion issue here with the Clark County hearing officer, and they go on to state in that number 651 that that hearing officer concluded, quote, that Converse consultants falsified inspection documentation, and that is wrong. It's unsupportable. As we said, the hearing officer, and it's a very small packet of documents to look through, the hearing officer never implied falsification. He only stated that Converse did not discover certain link beam defects. No other construction defects were at issue. Discovery in this case has shown that the injustice and the unfair prejudice that fell on Converse, who was, prior to this case, at the mercy of multi-billion dollar corporations and political motives, will never be completely undone, and there's still a lot of work to do. But the true detailed facts are steadily creeping up on the biased conclusory allegations. This court should instruct the lower courts not to tolerate misrepresentations and allegations and require a precision of pleading of specific fact words that satisfy each element of each claim for each transaction at issue. And I would like to
reserve.
You'd
never have to allow or provide leave to amend, which, as I recall, is to be freely given.
Freely given, of course, is not the issue. It's the when justice so requires that we submit triggers the propriety of the federal standard that the court should expressly adopt in this case, as we, I think, have briefed fully. Although I'm not sure that by itself that would have led to the justice that we seek. I would like to reserve the rest of my time or have an addition of time.
Okay, thank you very much. Mr. Omohundro.
Thank you. If it so may please the court, my name is Scott Omohundro. I represent Pacific Coast Steel. This writ involves a matter of pleading, not proof. By way of the writ, Converse wants this court to decide without a full record that Converse cannot be found liable for saying it conducted inspections of the reinforcing steel when it did not conduct those inspections. Converse signed inspection reports knowing full well that they would be relied upon by the steel subcontractors and knowing full well they did not conduct those inspections. Converse cannot satisfy either basis under IGT for writ relief. There are numerous factual disputes, as demonstrated by oral argument on both this and the motion to dismiss by Converse's counsel. And there's no important issue of law that requires clarification. Their sole argument on that basis is that Terracon precludes, or they claim Terracon precludes, PCS and Century from asserting a negligence-based claim for misrepresentation. That was not raised at the trial court. It was waived, should not be considered. Converse, in fact, concedes in its writ that pursuant to 552, a plaintiff may recover pecuniary loss, which is, quote, undoubtedly a subcategory of economic loss. Thus, the rule appears to define itself as an exception to the economic loss doctrine, and that's taken directly from their writ. Now, let's take a look at what really is at issue. The question is whether the steel subcontractors should have been given the opportunity to plead fraud, and whether they should have been given the opportunity to plead a claim for negligent misrepresentation under 552. The standard is whether it would be futile, whether it appears beyond a doubt that no facts exist, no facts could be alleged that would entitle PCS to relief. Now, PCS submits the application that standard is properly left to the district court, and there's nothing in the record demonstrating the district court in this case abused its discretion or acted capriciously. In terms of pleading fraud, that does need to be done with particularity, and that was done in this case. The standard is to plead sufficient facts to afford adequate notice to Converse, the opposing party, so it can defend against the charge and not just deny any wrongdoing. PCS and Century have done that and more. In fact, Converse concedes or acknowledges in its writ that the 62 inspection reports provide all the information needed to set forth the who, the what, the when, the where, and the how. But when defending against these allegations, Converse can do more than say it just simply did nothing wrong. It can specifically defend its conduct in connection with those 62 inspection reports.
What are we to do with the language of 112565 as to them being, in essence, a design professional?
The OTAC issue? Well, in terms of the OTAC issue, it was not specific to this writ in terms of the motion of relief to amend, but I would certainly take issue with Mr. Burris's representation that, or I think it may have been Mr. Edwards' representation that it's undeniable that they are a design professional. I think the district court would disagree with that.
If this court disagrees with you and grants the writ in this, in Mr. Burris's case or in Mr. Edwards' case, this writ becomes moot, doesn't it?
That's true, Your Honor. I think that the motion to dismiss subsumes the motion to leave to amend, in all honesty. But in terms of the design professional issue, that was recently raised by Converse to the district court several months ago when they moved to dismiss City Center's claim against them for poor inspections. And the district court ruled that, as pled, as an inspection agency, they were not defined as a design professional. And it is a factual issue that would require remand to have the district court make that determination on this case. Again, we're at the pleading stage, even in connection with a motion to dismiss. This is a motion for leave to amend, but it should be remanded for a factual determination. For example, the two inspectors were not engineers. That's been uncovered in discovery. So that's a factual issue that would go to whether or not they would be considered design professionals.
Counsel, I'm looking at portions of the amended complaint, pages 5, 6, and 7, and 8, for example. Could you identify for me where in those pages and in those allegations you believe you have stated a claim for intentional misrepresentation? Where do you state that there was a representation that was intentionally false? Could you point to the allegation and tell me which one you think applies?
And I apologize, Your Honor, I do not have the complaint in front of me in terms of paragraphs 5, 6, 7, and 8.
Uh-huh.
The representation would be contained within the 62 inspection reports, a representation that they inspected the work when, in fact, they did not inspect the work.
So in paragraph 21, I guess, you say, and I appreciate you don't have it in front of you, so I'll read it. Century Steel is informed and believes and thereon alleges that the conclusion of the Clark County hearing, the hearing officer concluded, among other things, that 62 daily inspection reports filed by Converse were flawed. Further, the billing official's final report issued after the conclusion of the Clark County hearing stated that 62 of the daily inspection reports were incorrect, not accurate, or not complete. Additionally, Century Steel is informed and believes and thereon alleges that the Clark County Building Department issued additional notices of violations for inspections performed by various other Converse inspectors regarding issues that were not the subject of the 62 daily inspection reports. Does that sound like the paragraph that you're saying alleges intentional misrepresentation?
That's part of the representation, and I know that I note that that's taken from Century's complaint. I think the factual allegations are very similar. There's also allegation in PCS's complaint, which refers to the Clark County Department of Development Services administrative hearing, the finding that Converse failed to discover the deficiencies, and it was a result of either a mistake, misinterpretation, incompetence, or something more nefarious.
Well, it looks like those would be allegations 722 on page 110 of the other complaint. These paragraphs, though, do not suggest, well, first of all, there seems to be some dispute about what the Clark County report says and how it could be used. But these paragraphs do not suggest to me that those reports found fraud or intentional misrepresentation. Do you allege something different than that? Are you suggesting that the Clark County hearing officer's report says they were fraudulent?
No, Your Honor. And that actually just supports the additional pleadings in our complaint. The fact that the allegations, the specific misrepresentations which are alleged to have been made, are that Converse inspected the work when they, in fact, did not inspect the work. They said they showed up, performed inspections, and they lied about it. The other allegation is that they misrepresented what they saw when they conducted the inspections. The Clark County administrative hearing, there was a finding that one of the inspectors could not even read the structural plans. And so that would suffice for an intentional misrepresentation because there was an insufficient basis to make a representation that the work, that reinforcing steel, was in compliance with the plans and applicable codes. So I think the administrative hearing certainly supports the allegations. Again, the two main misrepresentations being, one, that they conducted inspections when they did not, and two, that when they did conduct inspections, they misrepresented what they saw, and one of the bases for that is that they were incapable of actually performing those inspections. And to follow up on that, I mean, that's one of the elements. What we're left with, we believe we pled fraud with particularity. What remains are disputed issues of fact as to the elements of fraud. One of the primary elements at issue is whether PCS justifiably relied on the inspection reports. And I think, as you can tell, all of the oral argument has been infused with facts. I mean, these writs are basically thinly veiled, disguised motions for summary judgment that they seek a ruling on with an incomplete record. The facts are critical, and what has been discovered in discovery and what will be discovered in discovery.
Can I ask you to address another issue?
And sure.
I'm sure you're prepared to talk about it, knowing how thorough a lawyer you are, even though you're here on a different writ. But Justice Douglas posed a question about the relationship of 11258 or 259 to this problem in this particular writ. And I don't think Mr. Wall had a chance to comment about the words any action in the statute as covering these intentional misrepresentation and fraud claims. That was the rebuttal argument that Mr. Edward made. Would you like to comment about that and those, how the court should view those words in the statute in determining whether the amended complaints should be dismissed because the original complaints were void ab initio?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's two points there. One, in terms of the action, the district court properly defined it as the entire action, and she refused to dismiss, the district court refused to dismiss Century's and PCS's actions in their entirety because of an argument that the original negligence claims were void ab initio. She did not rule they were void, but one of the issues that she made clear on the record was that she could not dismiss it because action refers to the entire action, and we have multiple claims against multiple defendants. And in terms of actions, it also should be limited to professional malpractice. That is, in essence, the holding of OTAC. They dismissed the causes of action because there were claims for professional negligence against design professionals. And again, we believe there's a factual issue as to whether Converse would actually be considered a design professional, but we believe those. We believe, in essence, that the district court was right. The action is the entire action, and she could not dismiss that in its entirety, and so therefore the claims were not void ab initio. And I also like to point out that this argument was not raised originally when the court dismissed the negligence claims, and she dismissed the negligence claims originally back in 2010, and that was proper, and she dismissed the indemnity claims as a result of that. This argument was only brought up, not in the motion for leave to amend, but ultimately only on the motion for leave to dismiss. So we would submit that argument's been waived, and that's not appropriate for writ, and they have no relief. Again, I think it's not applicable to fraud or negligent misrepresentation. There is no need for an expert affidavit to demonstrate or prove that Converse lied. That's a factual question. And so we believe that we had the right and ability to amend our complaint to add negligent misrepresentation and fraud, which we did. And again, there's no requirement that we would have to submit an affidavit in support of that because, again, it's not a professional malpractice claim, which I believe 11.258 pursuant to OTAC should be limited to. Application of 552, that's not an issue in our motion for leave to amend. It was potentially at issue. I'm not entirely sure if it was in the papers, in the underlying papers. It was discussed. We would just like to emphasize, as we did at the oral argument on Hawcrow, that there's no logical reason to exempt Converse 552 should be applied across the board. That's the best policy. And according to the Supreme Court, Pennsylvania Supreme Court in Biltright, that's the modern trend, which is to apply an objective and uniform standard which limits liability to a defined class of plaintiffs. It's an intended reliance doctrine, and I think it's important that if, in fact, the court does address it, that it looks at that issue. If the court is, again, considering a blanket exoneration of design professionals pursuant to the Hall Court writ, which we obviously vehemently opposed, but if that is being considered, again, we would just submit that it's a factual question as to whether Converse is indeed a design professional. Just to end, I would like to just, again, reemphasize the fact that these writs are nothing more than motions for summary judgment. They're seeking to bar, to preclude our clients from pursuing a negligent misrepresentation claim and fraud claim against their client, a client that was tasked specifically with providing continuous inspections, the purpose of which was to verify the rebar in its final position was in compliance with the plans and applicable codes. Now, special inspections are a critical part of the checks and balances of any large construction project. We're responsible to build the plans, but the issue arises when there's a conflict between what's in two dimensions and what occurs in the field, and we hear the term congestion. That happened. Adjustments have to be made in the field, and it's up to the special inspector to come out and verify whether or not that work is in compliance with the plans and applicable codes. And based on that representation, PCS and Century continued to install in the same manner and method for 18 floors until ultimately an issue was identified by Halcro Yalis. We could not do any additional work until we received the affirmative representation from Converse that our work was in compliance with the plans and the applicable codes and the specifications. Concrete could not be poured onto the reinforcing steel until the representations were made in the inspection reports. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, Mr. Burrish, you have 4 minutes and 4 seconds.
Okay, I'll try to be fast, probably disjointed, but this case is certainly complicated. The only reason the true facts do not instantly defy the accusations is that I believe the facts are complicated. The court should note that if this was a simple two-party case, there would have been nothing to amend because all of their respective claims against Converse were dismissed in November of 2011, which included negligence and claims that we see again here for indemnity, contribution, declaratory relief. In a simple two-party case, PCS and Century would be required to commence and file a new completed complaint initiated in a new case against Converse. Pacifico Steel and Century would be required to serve a certificate of merit at the outset. Their claims would be subject to a 12B5 motion to dismiss and statute of limitations at a minimum. A proposed amended complaint must be in its final form and not be entirely missing the fraud claim, which is the most offensive for us and the most challenging for them. And when they allege what I would call pseudo-facts, such as Converse's reports, without identifying any one of those hundreds of reports, where they say Converse's inspections, without identifying what was inspected or when or by whom, they have not yet even begun to satisfy the lowest NRCP 8A requisite detail, much less 9B. The minimum notice pleading standard requires at least one actual fact, not these pseudo-generalization facts, actual fact that constitutes the grounds to satisfy each element for each claim. In this case, they would have a lot of work to do if they want to go down that road, but they can't. They cannot allege in the fraud who from Century or PCS heard anything from Converse that they relied on. They have not identified any people, and in written discovery, we said, tell us who it is that you believe heard anything from Converse that they're going to rely on. They gave us a list of people, including their foreman. Those people have been deposed. We asked every one of them. They identified Mr. Craig Brewell. Question. Okay, and what was the process of calling for an inspection? This is their general foreman, their senior foreman at the Harmon. Answer. Never had to call for an inspection. Preen took care of that. Question. So did you have any direct interaction with any of the inspectors for Converse? Answer. No. Do you know their names? No. Mr. Gruhl further stated he did not rely on Commerce to approve PCS's work. Question, what was the process? Was there a process by which you would be told whether or not the inspector had approved or had comments to the installation of the reinforcing steel? Answer, I never heard anything. Gruhl continued down that same line. They identified Mr. George Grace, who testified he did not speak with any Commerce inspectors. Jamar Williams, the night shift informant, testified that it was fair to say that he never consulted with inspectors, including Commerce, with respect to how to perform his job. Dennis Chavez, they identified, same thing, never spoke to Commerce inspectors. Every single one of them, we have wasted time asking these guys, so you're the one, you're the who for this fraud claim. Nope, it's not me. We still don't know who the who is, because in fact, they did not wait for Commerce to do anything. It was their quality control and quality assurance, independent duty to make sure they constructed correctly. It didn't matter what Commerce did. It didn't matter if Commerce had sent a team of inspectors down there to say, hey, you need to cut things and move things and do things some other way. They're required to ignore anything but the county-approved plans and the building codes.
So maybe we just mind our own business and you bring a properly founded motion for summary judgment in both of these matters and we're done.
That goes back to the basis for whether or not writ petition should be granted. And in this situation, pursuant to the IGT case, this is ripe for writ petition. This is extremely expensive, costly, protracted litigation. And the grounds for granting the motion for leave to amend to bring us into this lawsuit are utterly bad faith.
But this is a motion to dismiss, very simply stated, on the pleadings.
In the interest of justice and fairness, the court should remind the lower courts that allegations of fraud are serious because of the stigma, and make note of the fact that those accusations almost always give the accuser an instant advantage. And false accusations can almost never be undone. You can't unring the bell. You can't unscramble the eggs. And in this situation, justice is supposed to be blind. The lower court should not be determining whether or not I'm going to do it this way for this party or a different way for another party. The judgment by the court should be the same, even if she swaps the parties, even if you take away the parties. It should be approached as if it's just party X and party X2, and potentially one of these parties might be my loved one. How then am I going to rule? And we submit in this case, justice was not blind.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Rick. The case will stand submitted. Thank you all for your excellent briefs and arguments.